thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, a bi-weekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 11 for the 22nd of August 2007. Risky Business? Blogs on Campus, Part 2. I'm Dan Cohen. We are back once again with the 11th edition of Digital Campus, and happy to be back after a nice August recess for the podcast and for our lives in general. Here today with the regulars, Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
You guys have good vacations?
Yes,
I had an excellent vacation.
Good. Yes, you went to Hawaii. I think it's probably difficult to not have a good vacation there.
Yeah, and that's Tom, correct.
Tom, you were up in Rhode Island?
Yep, at the beach, and got some sun and some rest, and ready to be back at Digital Campus.
Great. Well, we of course have been away for a month, and then probably. And it seems like another week delayed because of our interminable Skype problems. I'm not sure if those in the audience who use Skype a lot probably know that there have been these horrific outages, and they're actually still plaguing us. We just couldn't seem to get the podcast sound working that well, just connection problems and bad sound and all kinds of stuff. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. So many people use Skype on campuses to, call long distance. This is going to be really problematic if it continues for another couple of weeks.
Yeah, I mean, little does the audience know that this podcast has already been going on for an hour while we tried to get everything working. I mean, even now, I think probably the sound's not that great.
Right. Yes. So we'll apologize in advance and see how this comes out, but this is the best sound we could get. It's really amazing that it took us an hour. We've been getting more proficient in getting our sound checks down, but all of a sudden it's gone back up because the Skype gods have not been smiling on us. Well, in addition to Skype, we have in our news roundup, we like to revisit some of our favorite issues, Wikipedia, iPhone, and Second Life are some of our favorites. And Mills, you noticed some interesting activity over the past month. First of all, neither of you still have an iPhone. I feel like I need to ask this at the beginning of every podcast, just in case someone ran out and got it. I actually played around with one on Sunday again. I just happened to be in the vicinity of an Apple store for some reason.
Just happened to be close by, did you?
Just, there was one. I was nearby. It was air conditioned, and so I had to go in and play around with the iPhone a bit more. Still don't like that Edge network, but they're very smart about always putting these things on Wi-Fi in the stores, so they
I actually went into an Apple store while I was on vacation and took the boys in, and so my 10-year-old, of course, is completely addicted to YouTube, silly 10-year-old YouTube videos, and so all he wanted to do was play YouTube videos on his iPhone. That he said, "Well, can we get one?" I said, "Sure, when you can afford it." But so I did the same thing. I switched the network, and YouTube just ground to a stop.
Right.
We gave up. We waited for several minutes and then just gave up. So, it wasn't just the store you went in where the problem exists.
Well, it seems like if Apple can't fix this problem, it looks like quote-unquote third-party developers may be working on some fixes here. It seems like the hackers are making a lot of good progress, and I kind of wonder what will happen to this as it moves along. Mills, you were sort of following this story.
Yeah, there was a piece in the Washington Post over the weekend about this, about hackers breaking into the iPhone in a variety of ways and adding their own applications. What the story led with an example of somebody who just can't live without Mario on his phone, and so he hacked into his iPhone and installed one of the legacy versions of Super Mario Brothers, and was then very happy. And this was just one of many examples of hackers breaking into the iPhone and installing a variety of what they see as upgrades to the phone. Apple then comes along and upgrades the software to the phone, closing whatever holes the hackers had found to get in and forcing them to rehack again, which they will, of course, continue to do because that's what they do. But it seemed to me that this was a nice, sort of an interesting contrast to the story we talked about with Facebook not too long ago, where Facebook has opened up its system to these third-party developers, as opposed to calling them hackers, to create all sorts of new applications for Facebook. And this is, I don't know if you guys have looked at it, but it's really taken off in Facebook. There are a lot of these applications that
it's
are
amazing how
popular.
Quickly they've gotten developers to do it. And indeed, some of these developers are making good money, and I think there's going to be a good market for these things. I mean, one company that makes one of these Facebook widgets has already been sold for $3 million. So I think there's probably money to be made, but I think more importantly, I think a lot of libraries and campuses are starting to write some applications into that environment because they know that everyone's coming in with a Facebook account.
It just makes no sense to me that Apple would close its system to third-party development. I mean, I know that Apple has always sort of been this way, but with the iPhone, it's really a different environment, I think, than the laptop or the desktop computer environment.
Right. I think the big contrast, if you look at the Facebook development platform, I think what they've done is very smart. You know, I mean, Apple says, well, we're open to third-party developers. You just have to write a web page that conforms to the standards. But what Facebook did that I think, you know, those of you in the audience who, you know, use Facebook regularly, you notice it has I think one of the reasons it succeeded is its design is so good and clean and crisp. And they didn't want to clutter that up in the way that MySpace has all these horrific-looking widgets and all kinds of monstrosities taking over the page when you go to visit someone's personal page on MySpace. They wanted to keep it look like Facebook but have other functionality. And what they did is, if you look into the development guidelines for Facebook, they have something called FBML, Facebook Markup Language, which is a subset of HTML. And you write to that specification, and then it looks just like every other little Facebook widget, and it conforms into the columns that they've set out. And they have something called FQL, which is the Facebook query language, which you use to extract information from the Facebook database. So if you want to find friends or things like that, they have a specific language. And of course, it's very restricted in terms of what you can do with it. But they've, in a sense, made a whole platform that really works well. And I think the developers have just jumped on that because they know, okay, I can write to this specification. It's going to look great in Facebook. And bing, you've got access to 30 million people on Facebook with your application right off the bat.
I'm actually going to suggest that what Apple's doing with the iPhone is actually not that different from what Facebook has done. Facebook was locked down for a long time.
That's true.
Or, you know, its first 18 months or so. And, that was a useful thing because it allowed Facebook to come into its own and to get everyone used to using this very kind of clean interface. And so when they did open it up, I mean, they put some technological restrictions in there, but there are also certain social restrictions that, like, no one's now going to really want to build an application that screws up the basic template, the basic layout of Facebook, because people like that layout. And I'm wondering if Apple isn't pursuing a kind of similar strategy where they're closing the iPhone for now, letting everybody get used to the interface. And in fact, with the iPhone more than any other probably consumer electronics product in history, it's the interface that's most important. And it's most important that Apple, you know, get a clean, usable very intuitive interface nailed down in these first few generations. And then maybe, you know, in a year or 18 months or something, they open it up to third-party developers when those third-party developers are now accustomed to looking at the iPhone the way it is and then won't build anything that goes contrary to the basic philosophy of the user interface.
Yeah, but Tom, what I don't understand about that strategy for Apple is, they're not a new platform in some sense, and so, you know, they already have a perfect contained environment that they can use, which is the dashboard widgets, which are written in JavaScript and XML. They even have the nice, pretty icons that you get when you launch dashboard and you get a calendar or, you know, weather radar or whatever you want. And it just seems to me like, couldn't they have released that spec, 3 months ago? I mean, or whatever, in January when Steve Jobs announced the phone was coming, the developers could have been working on these widgets for 6 months. There could have been quality control, and they could have launched with a whole library of these applications.
I guess I think the difference is with the whole marketing of the iPhone is that the iPhone is different. You know, that the iPhone, it's not going to be like your phone, which crashes all the time, or it's not going to be like your phone where you put some third party app on it and it's clunky, it kind of works, it kind of doesn't, it sometimes crashes your phone. The whole philosophy of the iPhone is like, it works out of the box. It's beautiful. It's seamless. It's perfect. And if you kind of let in, even dashboard widgets, they were worried that like some of these dashboard widgets that third-party developers would be building would interfere with that seamless environment. Because really, if the iPhone isn't that seamless experience, then it's just my BlackBerry. It's just a smartphone. It's a phone that does a lot of things. It's not the iPhone in the way that they've tried to market it. So in some ways, it may be less of a technical problem, a technological problem, than like a kind of branding or marketing or almost like personality problem for Apple.
Hmm. Yeah, I think those are good points. Well, it'll be interesting to see in a week how many students show up on our campus with one of these iPhones, and going back a couple of podcasts, see what expectations they have of its operation on the campus networks, and then later to see, Tom, I think, perhaps you're right, and to see if, for instance, universities can write specific applications to that. I mean, it'd be neat to have campus-based applications, maps, things like that for the campus that can be written directly to the iPhone. Well, in terms of quality control, there were a couple of really great, fun stories about Wikipedia, one of our favorite hobby horses here on the Digital Campus podcast. And one of them I thought was really great because it goes all the way back to our first podcast, which was about Wikipedia and the quality of what you find on Wikipedia. And some researchers at UC Santa Cruz created some software that uses an analysis of the history of each Wikipedia page. Remember that Wikipedia pages have a history. There's actually a tab, and you can go back and look at every single edit. And some of the pages have literally thousands of edits. And so those kinds of pages tend to be of a higher quality because a lot of people have looked at them and a lot of people have made edits. And I think they went an extra step too at looking at who made these edits and whether they were one-off people who've just made a single edit or whether they were people who've made thousands of edits. And I guess the inference being that those people are more reliable. And they've gone ahead and actually color-coded some sample pages. We'll throw up a link on the Digital Campus website at digitalcampus.tv. to show you some of these things. But I thought it's an interesting first step, and I'd like to see, in the future, maybe the Wikimedia Foundation incorporate some of these technologies, maybe just an overlay where you could click on it and say, hey, is this page, reliable? Because I think a lot of people don't click on that history page and don't know how much something's been edited or who's been editing it. The other story, just before we begin the conversation on this, is the Wiki Scanner story, where Again, another software project to look at who's been anonymously editing Wikipedia. Again, I guess goes to the question of quality. But there's some new software called WikiScanner that will basically look at the IP addresses of each edit. And indeed, Wikipedia has saves IP addresses for each edit, and then does a reverse lookup to find the domain name of that IP or what IP range that domain name sits in, and can tell you, is someone at the CIA editing a passage, or someone at a university, or anything like this. And I think tools like this combined will really change the nature of how we view Wikipedia articles.
Yeah, and I think that the UC Santa Cruz application will really appeal to younger users of Wikipedia, because there's a reputational factor involved, which is one of the things that certainly works in these social networking environments, is finding ways to gain reputation and or karma or whatever it might be. And so this is what the Santa Cruz application does, is that the more lasting your edits are, the more reputation you gain as an editor.
So that's how it works. It's looking at actually at the length of time as well.
The length of time. So, for instance, if you edit something and then somebody goes in and reverts to the previous version, then you lose reputation. Then the next editor comes in and changes other things on the page but not yours, then you gain some reputation.
My question with that is, does that like really help us learn anything new? So that means if a mistake lasts a long time, then it becomes less of a mistake. It just doesn't seem necessarily to help all that much.
Yeah, it could be that it just kicks the kicks the problem down the road a bit of
figuring
sort of
what
out. Yeah. It certainly there's. I think in the wiki model, it seems that, at least for now, there's no way of solving the problem of, one person being right, but then 10 other aggressive editors who believe the opposite of a fact or a statement being aggressive in changing it back. I mean, that one person could be right. And so that notion that Wikipedia somehow approaches truth through editing, it still has that problem of, what if the majority is wrong?
Right. I think, you could also make, you could, and, I haven't thought this all the way through because I'm just reading this now, but like, you could almost make the opposite argument that like the pages on which changes last the least amount of time are the ones you can trust the most, because they're being heavily edited and refined over and over and over again. And that like very, that quick iterative editing is what makes Wikipedia truthful.
Yeah, I've never understood
It's not the lasting nature of. I mean, the 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica has lasted a long time. Doesn't mean everything in there is truth.
Well, I don't understand why Wikipedia doesn't just foreground a bit more how many times a page has been edited.
Yeah, you think it'd be easy enough to put a counter or something on.
Right. I mean, it's not always the case, but I think, you're right. If an article's been edited 3,000 times, it's going to be better than one that's been edited 3 times or by one person. Seems like some simple.
Also it would also be useful to know how many times it's been edited recently. So 3 edits in the last month or 30 edits in the last month. So there's been some sort of flurry of activity or nothing going on.
Right. Yeah, and then with WikiScanner, I haven't started playing with it yet, but I assume that, journal like perhaps Chronicle of Higher Ed is probably using that quite a bit to find some embarrassing tidbits. Professors changing their own biographies or universities whitewashing some controversial issue on campus. Undoubtedly, we're going to find something like that in the next couple of weeks as people ping through this. Well, finally, our other favorite hobby horse, the nature of Second Life. And I saw a really funny blog headline this week about Second Life saying, last avatar to leave, please turn off the lights. And we've often wondered here since we've all explored Second Life and wonder if anyone's home. Tom, you saw a story about this of a university making a really big move into Second Life and then the results of that.
Yeah, I don't know if we mentioned it on the podcast or not, but a couple of months ago, Case Western Reserve launched a virtual campus where in Second Life where you could do a kind of campus tour, and I think it was geared mostly towards admissions, so that you know if you couldn't you know afford a plane ticket to Cleveland or couldn't get in your car and get there, you could still kind of virtually visit Case Western in Second Life, and that story broke to kind of a lot of fanfare in places like the Wired Campus blog of the Chronicle of Higher Ed and you know the various other ed tech kind of blogs, and you know and it seems like a really good idea, but I think it you know my question has with Second Life, as you just said, Dan, has always been like, well, is anybody home? And it turns out that Case Western just released some numbers, and it looks like only about 40 people, quote, wandered by this virtual campus in Second Life, and that doesn't really tell you. So they wandered by. It doesn't really even tell you anything about how they used it, whether it was useful or anything else. But it seemed like Case Western made a fairly large investment in the Second Life campus, and you know the return on that investment has only been 40 visitors, which seems a little disappointing.
And speaking as a former admissions consultant, direct mail is probably a lot cheaper than what they invested in putting that virtual campus together.
Yes, but Mills, this was much hipper.
Yes, hipper. Yes, successful. No.
Right. Well, we'll have to leave it there on Second Life, and we'll come back and beat it up again, I guess, on our next podcast. Now let's move on to the feature story, our second half of our conversation on blogging. On Digital Campus number 10, we had our first half of our discussion on blogs and how they can play a productive and effective role in academia. And listening back on that podcast, we realized that it was all sweetness and light. And so we wanted to have a second part to the discussion today and discuss really, you know, how to get started with blogging and the tough questions that we run into, like how you keep your blog going, how you build up an audience, how do you come up with things to post, how do you write? And I think maybe we'll just walk through each one of these questions, and hopefully that will be helpful to the audience. And as always, people who are bloggers out there who have other hints on how to blog well are welcome to join in the discussion and add a comment to this episode, episode number 11, on our site, digitalcampus.tv. So Mills and Tom, we talked a little bit last time on, you know, how we got started blogging and why we got started. But do you want to describe maybe, you know, your process? What is your daily process in putting your blog together, a weekly process? You know, how often do you post? How do you come up with stories? You know, I think that I've been a more infrequent poster than the two of you, although I'm thinking now that I've converted to WordPress, I'm going to try to blog a little bit more frequently. But maybe, Mills, could we start with you? I mean, what is your process, and how do you get over the problem of, I guess, what's called blog fading, or this propensity of bloggers to kind of burn out?
Well, for me, it's really a weekly process. I simply don't have enough time to blog on a daily basis, and I'm not exactly sure how other people who blog more than I do have that kind of time, but clearly they do. So for me, it's really a weekly thing, and I have kind of a two-part strategy for keeping the blog going in that sense. One is I set aside a day in every semester, which is the day that I'm going to make sure and post something. So it might be Tuesday morning this semester. I set aside time in my calendar to actually write something for the blog, and I set that up as a repeating event in my calendar, and so it always reminds me to do that. And then the second thing is, as the week goes along, I save things that I think would be useful to post in my blog, given the subject of my blog on technology and education and history, as I come across things, I will go ahead and post those to you say I use Delicious to keep track of things that are online, or if it's out of the newspaper or I find it somewhere else, I stick it in a folder. And so then on that Tuesday morning, I come to it and decide what I'm going to write about. The other thing, though, is that often I will run across something right away that I want to go, I'm inspired to go ahead and write for the blog. And so I do. So I don't hold back until Tuesday morning because that's when I post. I may go ahead and sit down and write something immediately. But for sure, if I haven't posted anything in a week, I try on that day that I've set aside, I try to write something. So that's given me a discipline and kept me posting on a regular basis.
Tom, how about you?
Yeah, Mills, I think my process is sort of similar to yours, but I have to say I'm pretty impressed with how regular and rigorous your process is. I mean, I do use the same kind of Delicious bookmarking trick that you do. I, you know, go through the week and I collect all the things I find out there on the web and wherever, and I bookmark them in Delicious, and I have a tag that I refer to when it comes time to post. But I don't think I don't have a certain day of the week or a certain time of the day when I do that posting. And I sort of, and maybe I should, because I don't think I'm really the model of good posting practice. I'll go weeks where I don't post at all, and then I'll have a week where I post every single day. And I really do struggle with like consistency in posting. And I think consistency in posting is, you know, a hugely important for building an audience. I think when you get people subscribing to your feed, while you don't have to write something every day, if you don't write something, you know, if you go 2 weeks or a month without writing something, people will sometimes clean out their feed reader and say, oh yeah, I'm not reading this one anymore. I'll get rid of this. And you do lose subscribers. So I think like a strategy like yours, Mills, where you're really have a pretty strict schedule, and if that's what you need to keep you posting consistently, I think that's a really good idea, and maybe I should take that advice myself.
Well, my process is, I think, you know, pretty similar to the two of you. I actually use the star function in Google Reader now quite a bit, so I'll, you know, I get a lot of my sort of news that I might want to comment on straight in Google Reader. And I'll star it, and just that sort of just puts it in a folder of, you know, important posts that I'll then revisit. But, you know, it's interesting, Tom, your point about consistency in posting. I have to say, when I started blogging, I had actually a very long post on this about, you know, the nature of RSS. And my point of the post was RSS is great because it allows us to sort of post irregularly and infrequently, because the reader will pick up when someone posts a fresh post. Whereas if you're posting every day, it's like the New York Times. It comes every morning on my doorstep, and I know I can go to that object or that website and see, okay, there's a new post. But what's great about RSS is it's a push mechanism, and it pushes it out to the reader. But I do think you're right, and this does get into, I guess, some of the tensions about blogging and some of the worries about blogging, and I guess some of the negatives about blogging, which is, you know, I have come around to that point that it is true that people consider a blog to be a sort of ongoing conversation between the author and an audience. And if you are erratic, it does become easy to kind of tune out a blog. And so I think all of us feel the pressure to post. You know, I have to say on that point, this is part of my impetus to moving from my own blogging software to WordPress, was so that I could write drafts. I didn't have a draft capability in my own software. And so one of the things I'm doing now in WordPress is I'll just put a little stub for an article, you know, a title or a few URLs into a draft, and then I'll revisit that. And it might take me months or a couple of days to revisit it. But part of the reason I've gone to WordPress is I think it will help me to post more quickly. I also think, you know, we should probably point out to people who haven't started a blog yet that, you know, you don't necessarily have to do the full-blown WordPress, Blogger, movable type classic blog.
Great point.
Yeah, you know, there are all these kind of new microblog platforms like Tumblr, which is at TUMBLR.com. Of course, drop the E because it's Web 2.0.
Web 2.0?
Yeah, and, you know, like, for instance, Tumblr is just a great, they call it tumblogging. And it's just sort of like a low barrier to entry way of just, you know, maybe posting a link with one line of a comment or an image you found or a YouTube video. So very easy to do, doesn't have a lot of the pressure that we feel of, at least I feel of, you know, I really edit my posts extensively, try to make them as well-written as I can. And, you know, with something like a Tumblog or some of these other micro-blogging platforms, and I would include in that, you know, something like Facebook as yeah. well, you can kind of have a blog that's a little bit less intense and maybe a little bit easier to do.
I think that's a great point. I mean, I think there are a lot of these new services out there which allow for these kind of short form posts. I mean, you know, you would put Twitter and Jaiku in that category as well. And I don't think the other thing I would say is I don't think having one blog on WordPress or that sort of a longer form blog precludes having also a kind of shorter form blog on one of these other platforms. I mean, I don't think you want to dilute your message too much, but I think you can. I think you can do both, and they can serve different purposes.
See, I want to disagree with that. I think that to do a blog well, you have to put some time and effort into it. I mean, the blogs that are successful are the ones that are carefully thought out. They're well written. Even if the postings are really short, they're worth reading. And I've looked at some of these Tumblogs and some of these other really short blog postings that Dan's talking about, and there's just no way that I'd subscribe to one of those. I mean, they're mostly just kind of random thoughts splashed out onto the internet, and I'm no fan of those at all.
I do think that is a good point. You know, I look at the stats for readers of my blog, and you know, there are these posts. I think Jacob Nielsen's called it evergreens, and these, you know, the single posts that your blog becomes known for. And I think all three of us probably have a few posts that, if you look at the monthly stats, you know, a post might be a year old, but people keep going back to that post because a lot of people have linked to it, or you know, find it in a Google search because it covers a particular topic very well and extensively.
Yeah, and you know what's amazing? I definitely do. And what's amazing about it is, you know, it's not the ones you would think it would be. Like the ones that I'm most proud of are not the ones that seem to have gotten the real traction there. So you know, I mean, it is hard, this, you know, writing for this really diffuse anonymous audience. I think it's different than writing a journal article where you have a good sense of who the subscribers to, you know, this or that journal are. You have no idea who's going to subscribe to your blog, and so it's difficult, or do a search and end up stumbling on your blog. It is a hard thing to write for.
Well, Tom, you know, how do as we're trying to get Mills's sound quality up a little bit better, you know, how do you go about building an audience? It's an odd thing, isn't it? I mean, you can't see them. You're not meeting them in the streets. You know, for new people, I think a lot of people don't realize that it can take months or years to build up a decent-sized blog audience. You know, how do you begin to do that process?
Yeah, it is. It's difficult. It's interesting. When I first started blogging, and I think, Dan, you went through a very similar process. I think probably we went through it in parallel.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the blog as something that I would write, and you know, maybe people would read, maybe they wouldn't. But it was really like I wasn't thinking in terms of an audience relationship. I was thinking in terms of, you know, sort of strict authorship, where the authority rested with me, and you know, if people wanted to buy it, they would buy it, and if they didn't, they wouldn't. And so, like, I didn't have comments open on my blog for at least the first few months. I didn't use tags on my blog because I thought, well, you know, I don't need to give it a keyword. People can read the post if they want, or they can, you know, if they it'll show up in a Google search, and I don't need to use tags or a tag cloud or anything like that.
Right.
And I realized you know, after doing this for a little while, that those things, those comment forms and those, you know, the categories and the tags and all of those sort of features that you see on blogs, they're not just there for, you know, kind of web. They're not like web 2.0 gimmicks. They're really there for that. Using those things is a big part of building an audience, and having comments open allows readers to engage with your blog, and you can be pretty sure that someone who comments on your blog is also going to subscribe to your blog. And they might even mention your blog on their blog if they've got a comment on your blog, because it'll, you know, direct traffic their way. And so allowing for that kind of interactivity through tags and comments and these other kind of community features, I think is at least one important step in building an audience.
The other thing you have to do, though, is just you have to flog your blog when it first gets started. You have to go to other people's blogs. You have to comment on their posts. You have to link back to your own blog. You have to do the kinds of things that get your own voice embedded in the conversation that's already taking place. The other thing you have to do is set up your blog in Technorati so that the search engine finds you, rather than depending on potential readers to find you on their own through their random searches of the internet.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And we'll put up a link to claiming your blog on Technorati. I think that's a good point, although it does seem that Technorati's fading, their star is fading a little bit. But I think doing things like that, making sure that your blog is, you know, very accessible to search. And I think, Tom, your point about tag clouds, I mean, I also find them kind of silly. But you know, some way for people to kind of find what's on your site. You know, one of the things I'm thinking about doing right now on my blog, now that I'm over in WordPress, is just having a page of the 10 or 15 best posts that I've written that someone can just click on a tab and see, okay, here's what I've done that's sort of the best. And there are, you know, dozens or hundreds of other posts that are perhaps lesser. But if you want to see the best of what this one is about, this blog is about, here it is.
Yeah, so, and I think using those tags kind of strategically is important. Like if you take a look at your logs and you've got a post, like I've got a post on timelines that is one of my most popular posts. Having a tag timelines in your sidebar is, I mean, obviously for some reason people find this timeline post interesting, and having a tag in the sidebar and at the bottom of that particular post that says timelines allows that reader who's interested in timelines to go find other places on my blog where I've mentioned timelines. So using those tags strategically, I think can help keep readers, which I think is an important part of this too. It's not just gaining a reader once, it's keeping the reader and keeping them as a subscriber.
Right. I think that's a great point is, you know, once you have a subscriber, you have to kind of continue to meet certain expectations with that person. And again, I think this goes back to some of what we talked about on the first half of the show. And, you know, that is coming up with a topic that you're very enthusiastic about, sticking to that topic, you know, not talking about what, you know, you had for breakfast that morning, because that's just what struck you, you know, the morning you decide to post to your blog. So I think those kinds of things. Do you want to talk a little bit more about maybe some of the, you know, the things that, you know, you've got a kind of broader readership or wider readership, I would think. Actually, both of the two of you do. I think I have mostly a kind of academic and librarian audience, the way I've crafted my blog. But I think both of you reach a much wider audience. And Mills, you've actually been contacted by people, for instance, when you've blogged about Wikipedia, Wikipedians.
Yeah, I mean, I because of a lot of the things that I've written about Wikipedia and education, I've gotten actually a lot of traffic from some of the Wikipedia editors' forums. And that's been very interesting to be part of that discussion. There are a number of high school teachers who pay pretty close attention to what's going on in my blog, because I also have a fair amount to say about secondary education and technology's implications for that. And a certain number of archivists as well are pretty interested in the kinds of things that I've been writing about. So I do have kind of this very mixed audience.
Hmm. So how about some other possible negatives? I mean, what about, you know, blog balancing your blog versus, let's say, other writing? Is this something we should worry about, or, you know, does it matter really where we publish, you know, what we're thinking, or does the blog serve a different purpose? Can we overblog? Is it possible to overblog?
Sure. Well, I think you can overblog. I think for one thing, you can wear your audience out. But I also think that you have to think carefully about where you stand in your particular career trajectory. I mean, for tenure track faculty members, for instance, obtaining tenure is very important. And so in most research-oriented universities, that means for historians anyway, publishing a book, or for other other specialties, there are other sorts of measurements. And regular posting in a blog, to my knowledge, isn't one of the criteria for promotion and tenure at very many institutions around the country. So you can't let it get in the way of those sorts of objectives. I guess my message is that you really have to balance your blog writing against whatever your other professional responsibilities are.
Yeah, I'm trying to think through this right now. I mean, I'm up for tenure this year, this school year. And, you know, the more I blog, the more I like the immediacy of it and, you know, and the reach of it. And I now have a fairly large audience that I know I can reach with a blog post. And it's going to be hard to think about, you know, what the future of publishing will be. I mean, I have another book brewing, but I'd like to make it open access as I did for digital history, of, you know, putting it all online. And will publishers be okay with that? Or can I blog part of it? Should I just blog my thoughts that go into it? I think these are very interesting questions. And I think there's a lot of interesting studies going on right now about, you know, the nature of publishing. And I think things are just starting to shift. And this conversation we're having is probably going to be a lot different in 5 years with just some of the things I've seen. You know, there was a great, very interesting article on just the top economists at, I think it was at Harvard Business School, who are choosing less and less to publish in the top journals in their field because they feel, you know, well, hey, I have tenure. I obviously have a good reputation. What does it really matter where I publish it? You know, if I publish in an open access journal that some people feel is a second tier, you know, who cares? It gets the material out there. And so I think there's some erosion at this point going on with classic, you know, print-based peer review. And I think it'll be interesting to sort of track that and to see, you know, what role, you know, blogging and blogs play in that erosion.
Yeah, but I would also add, as a tenured faculty member with graduate students, for graduate students who are blogging, if you're trying to complete a dissertation, they should all remember that the object of writing a dissertation is to finish.
Right. Yes. Sadly, I think that advice is more for the better. It may, perhaps it has silenced a few of our friend bloggers at the Center for History and New Media. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there and move on to our picks for the week. Well, we're going to end this ill-fated Skype podcast this week with, as usual, with a few sites that we found and resources and software tools that we found looking around the web. And maybe, Tom, we'll start with you this week.
Yeah, I don't know if I've mentioned this. I might have mentioned it briefly on the podcast before, but I think it's apropos for our discussion today. It's www.museumblogs.org, which is a museum blog directory, and there are I don't know even how many, maybe more than 200 blogs in this directory of. These are essentially museum professionals, museum webmasters, public programs people, curators, students in museum studies who have blogs, and they sign up for this directory. The directory is edited. It's vetted by I think it's created by the people at IDEAM, which is a which is a...
are they a web design firm?
Yeah, they're a web design firm in Albuquerque, I think. And they do great work. And it's just it's a good place to find blogs in the museum field. But they've also got on there. It's also an aggregator, so they've got an RSS feed, and you can subscribe to the RSS feed and get the snippets from the latest posts of all 200 blogs in the directory. It can be a little bit overwhelming at times because you wake up and you open up your feed reader and there's 150 new entries from the museum blogs,
right.
But it's well done, and the feed is structured in such a way that it's easy to scan through them. So, museumblogs.org.
Sounds great, and it sounds like a good way to actually reach an audience. If you're just starting out a blog, you can get in that directory, and that's a great way to reach a new audience.
Yeah, definitely.
Mills, what did you find for this week?
The site that I want to mention is one that I actually learned about while I was on vacation this summer and just reading the local newspaper, and it's called the Hawaiian Nisei Story, and this is the story of Japanese Americans or Americans of Japanese descent who were living in Hawaii after Pearl Harbor, and so it's really an exemplary website for the kind of small budget historian operation. This is done by the University of Hawaii and Kapi'olani Community College, and to create the website. And this is neither of these places has a Center for History and New Media or something like that. And they put together a really nice site that includes oral histories with veterans from Hawaii, Japanese American veterans, with some video, some transcripts, some primary sources, lots of images. It's just a really nice site for both for the kind of casual historian interested in Japanese Americans during the Second World War, but also those interested in Hawaiian history. So it's really a great website.
Sounds good. We'll surf on over there. And again, I want to remind everyone that we'll put these links up in our show notes. For this week, I'd actually like to once again plug Zotero, but this time in a very particular way. We're really excited to announce, actually, this podcast will likely come out on Wednesday, August 22nd, and that is the very day that Mozilla, which is the corporation that makes the open source Firefox web browser, has announced that they will release a special version of Firefox called Firefox Campus Edition, and this is for the back to school season. And what I really like about Firefox Campus Edition is that it ships with Zotero pre-installed, and actually a couple of other very popular Firefox extensions as well. Foxy Tunes, which allows you to control iTunes from right within the web browser, and StumbleUpon, which helps you find sites that might interest you on the web. And so all three of those extensions are preloaded into this edition. It should be a nice little bundle, and so if you know a student, grad student, faculty member who hasn't yet downloaded Firefox and you want to point them somewhere that where they can get a nice sort of back to school special. The price is perfect. It's free, like all of our stuff. And this will be available at on the Mozilla website. And again, we'll have a direct link to the back to school special from our show notes. So, Mills, Tom, again, sorry for the audio problems. We'll blame it on Skype. And hopefully things will sound a lot better on our 12th edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country